Niño, vente conmigo, escúchame. Te cuento una cosa. De unos hombres. Ay, estos hombres eran hombres bravos. Llegaban de África con la fuerza y la belleza. Ay, fijo, conquistaban la ignorancia y la bestia en la humanidad. Daban al mundo la luz y el fe. Y también el Dios cósmico. Los llamamos los conquistadores chocolates.
Thank you. Oh, so pleased to be doing this today. A little bit of old school, a little bit of original boogie. It's Giles Peterson out of the podcast situation. And I've got a very special guest with me. A very, very special guest. His name is Snowboy.
Hi, mate. It's good to see you.
Very good to see you too. First of all, before we start talking about your book, From Jazz Funk to Acid Jazz.
Yeah, From Jazz Funk Confusion to Acid Jazz, yeah.
I wanted to thank you, actually, because a few years ago I had a bit of a problem with my left ear, and you were one of the people that I called up in a panic, and you were brilliant with me, and you really made me feel better about everything, and, you know, made me understand my ear, because you'd had a few, well, I don't know,
had
your problems, hadn't you?
I've been through the same thing, yeah.
Are you feeling good? How are your ears now?
I just accepted the fact that that's the thing with these things, once you accept the fact that you have a problem with one of these things,
you know,
then you can get on with things a lot better.
And it's funny because these days I don't even remember having a. It's weird. I think your brain eventually gets used to it, and you just.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't notice I have a problem in my ear. I just don't notice it at all anymore.
Yeah, we're just getting completely dull to it. We've probably got extremely big problems.
we're getting older and falling apart, Giles.
We are now. Listen, I'm pleased you're here. I'm really pleased you're here. I'm particularly. Delighted to say that I got your book. There'd been a lot of talk about it for ages and ages that you were doing this book. In fact, you interviewed me like, I don't know, what seems like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was this talk about this book that you were writing, and it's finally come out, even though there were a few spelling mistakes that they're fixing.
Yes, 250 spelling mistakes, yeah.
To be exact. Yeah. Okay, talk about your book, tell us about it, and will you ever do it again?
Let's start with the last question first. No, I would never ever do another book again. Certainly nothing of that size. It's 300 pages long. It's about 120,000 words, it's quite a thankless task, you know, for years. I mean, I've been working on the book over a 10-year period, and. I mean, even I gave up halfway through thinking that no one's going to be interested in it, and I really started to, you know, lose the way with it a little bit. And there's a lot of people in the scene being very negative about the book as well. And in fact, I mean, I remember once driving all the way up to Leeds to interview some people, and all the way there, and they never even turned up. And when we got hold of them, they said, oh, they were decorating their lounge that afternoon or something, and you know, you got that kind of, you know, people, you know, thing where you didn't think people were that interested. So the reason I forged ahead and finished it was because I realized I was playing with people's feelings, you know. There's a lot of 95% of the people I interviewed in the book never been interviewed in their lives, and it meant a lot to them, and it meant a lot to their family and friends. And and I was constantly getting pestered, when's the book coming out, when's the book coming out? And I'm thinking, God, I'm only halfway through, you know. And I suddenly realised then that it wasn't just about me writing the book, it's about, I am playing with other people's feelings. And that was one thing that really pushed me ahead to finish it. It certainly won't be for monetary gain, that's for sure. I don't imagine, but
that's what they say. No. That's what they all say at the beginning.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't feel like that, definitely. But then again, this book is so it's deep, but it's not anal to the point of being boring. I felt maybe it's because I could relate to all of it. The point is, it's talking about a particular scene that you've led all the way through to the beginning of Acid Jazz, which is what year?
It goes through to more or less the really big explosion, worldwide explosion, which is probably about 93, something around there. You know, I mean, I'm talking about when it's really massive, you know. By then, really, a whole new generation had discovered that music and didn't really understand the jazz side of acid jazz, you know, whatever acid jazz was, you know. And you suddenly realise then that the idea of playing Coltrane or Blakey or Chick Corea to a dance floor was probably not going to be happening, you know, on a large scale anymore after that, because it became a worldwide fashion, you know, people. You know, I mean, as you know as well as I do, I mean, acid jazz means something to everybody. You know, I mean, a lot of people just don't realise it. You know, obviously started off as a joke, you know, so, amongst your crowd. So
I think a lot of people actually, what people need to know as well, who are listening to this, who might not know, Snowboy, you've basically been one of the key DJs out of Essex,
yeah.
Inspired by the Gold Mine, Chris Hill,
yeah.
All that. It's all in the book. Mm. And you then basically went on to, apart from DJing, you ended up being a very high-level professional musician, performing on one side with people like Lisa Stansfield, and on the other side doing all your Snowboy projects.
Yeah.
You've made a lot of albums.
Yeah, 15 albums. Yeah,
yeah, so... You know, this is you're in it. I mean, did you feel that it was important to... I mean, I think it's incredible that you've done this, and I feel very proud and privileged to have been part of a movement that's actually... There's something there on print which says that it happened. I think it's important for any form of music, because what ends up... Things get mistold or misunderstood in the future, so we know there's something in there in the reference library, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Was that one of the reasons before you kind of started feeling that you had a responsibility emotionally to all the people you interviewed? Was one of the reasons that you felt that you really wanted this to be to be written down?
Because I mean that was the original reason I started doing the book in the first place, because I felt that I overheard some jazz dancers one day talking about certain things, a certain thing that had happened in the scene, and I remembered it as clear as anything. It's been two years before that, and I remember thinking, blimey, all this stuff is getting forgotten about and exaggerated. Someone's going to document it, and I thought, if someone's going to document it, it may as well be me, because I have been very dedicated to that stuff since the late 70s, really. I mean, as an underage drinker, I mean, I used to hire the Gold Mine out as a 17-year-old one Wednesday a month to put my own jazz funk nights on, so I've kind of, I've always been very dedicated to every little nuance of the scene and celebrate every offshoot of it. And I'm glad that I started doing it. I just didn't realise what a massive job it was going to be and how many hours it would take. I mean, for each interview probably lasted 2 or 3 hours. Then I had to write it out by hand, and self-edit as I went along, clear all the rubbish out that we didn't need, and then of course the typing and of it all, so which my wife did, and so it was, the process went on forever. The key thing that really made me finish the book off, and I'm not going to speak bad of them, because I particularly Bill Brewster, because I really really do like Bill, but I really felt that that they almost totally ignored our scene in that amazing book of theirs, Last Night a DJ Saved My Life. It's an incredible book, but we were almost totally ignored in there. And there's another incredible book by Peter Shapiro, who's an Englishman who lives in America, who did an incredible book on the history of disco. I mean, and he gives our scene one page in there, and it's just so derogatory. And those two books really, really pushed me on, I thought, no, this is wrong. We really, our scene, especially the jazz funk scene, was as big as the house scene ever became. It was a countrywide massive scene, wasn't it? I did feel that the story had to be told. It wasn't just going to be one-sided, I could ramble on all day long about that,
No, well, one of the things I thought was great about the way the book was, you've written the book, is you took a leaf out of the Tito Puente autobiography, which was basically a bunch of interviews.
Yes.
Right, and so you basically interviewed all these people and you've made sense of it over the story of the book. I mean, it's funny because there have been so many different stories that have gone from different people and things get exaggerated and whatever, but when you read it all within the sort of the depth of the book, in the end the truth comes out,
yeah,
if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's what I tried to do.
It's good. Okay, this, we actually started off this episode with I can't stop laughing. It's good having you opposite me. We started off with three kind of what you would call bona fide classic jazz functions.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, dancers' favourites. These are the tracks that inspired us all to go on to dance to So out and out jazz, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So which one?
We started with Johnny Hammond.
Oh gosh, of course we did. Which you tried to play this weekend at Southport.
Yeah, I couldn't manage to fit it in anywhere. But it's about time that had a revival, I think, to the masses.
Yeah, that's had it.
Los Conquistadores Chocolates, and then what? Royer's Evolution.
Mm.
Then Crown Heights Far Outs, and
It. Now we're about to play. We're about to play the, I suppose, possibly the biggest tune, which is still. I mean, there's a really good article about Expansions by Don Liston Smith, or a story in your book about when that first came out. Is it Chris Hill talking about it?
No.
Someone's talking about.
No. That was research I had. You know, which I found from looking at. I think it was in an old Black Music and Jazz Review magazine, and.
Because the year that Lonnie Liston Smith Expansions came out, there was a bunch of other incredible records came out that year.
Yeah. Well, I guess some of what we've just been playing were around that time. You know, because obviously CTI and Kudu just a couple of years previous had started to do that kind of funky jazz. They didn't have a name for it at that point. They started calling it crossover jazz in America in Billboard. They weren't terming it as jazz funk at that point. And it seemed to me around this kind of 1975 kind of period, you started having the Mazelle Brothers productions coming through, didn't you? Like, you know, like Johnny Hammond that we just heard, and Bobby Humphries and Donald Byrd, of course, and of course Lonnie Liston Smith Expansions. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, I've never, you know, the thing is with that record, we've all heard it 1,000 times. You've really got to put yourself back to. Try and remember what it was like the first time you heard it. And I mean, really, I never ever heard a record like that in my life. The impact it must have made as coming out as a new release must have been beyond belief, you know. It ended up becoming staple diet on the dance floors over here, although it wasn't really big at all in America as a dance floor record. It was a top number one jazz record. But Lonnie Liston Smith said when he came over here, to see the when the record was reissued over here in 1978, it was the first time he'd ever seen people dancing to it, because he didn't make it as a dance record. We'll be right back.
Yes, we're going straight in at the deep end with Snowboy, who has just put out a book. It should be out any minute now. You can pick it up by ordering it, right?
Yeah, you can, yeah. Yeah.
You can't just get it in foils or borders.
You can in...
Can you?
Yeah, by the end of May, it'll be available anywhere. You know, Borders, foils, Waterstones, all
it's
those.
It's not too specialist for those people.
No, it's going to be definitely available in those
shops. I hope so. So we're kind of trying to play some... I mean, there's so much of this music which is sort of fundamental to the book, which we're playing the soundtrack right now, right? Chick Corea with Central Park.
Yeah.
And the bass line, very similar on this one. I haven't heard this for ages.
Same bass player.
It sounds like Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah, it's Bunny Brunel. Yeah. Blatant Jaco Pastorius rip-off merchant, but amazing all the same. Your Honour.
love it. Okay, so, I mean, I want to get into your head a little bit and just get a little bit of your history, because you interviewed everybody and there isn't really a great deal of Snowboy in there. I suppose you're all-encompassing in the book, of course, but what was your history and who were the DJs that really influenced you the most when you were growing up?
I was very lucky to only live a couple of miles from one of the greatest clubs ever anyway, which does feature heavily in the book, which is the Goldmine, with the DJ Chris Hill. And only 15 miles down the road in Chelmsford, you had Bob Jones. I mean, really, in some ways, Bob Jones and Chris Hill were rivals, even though Bob was on a much smaller level, because, you know, they both were, you know, I can't say one influenced me more than another, but they were both very, very jazz biased.
Chris Hill was the first superstar DJ, wasn't he?
He was the first. Yeah, I mean, he was earning £1,000 a night at the Goldmine in 1979. People can't imagine that you would earn that kind of money, you know.
He was I remember him at K-Star, and I was, 17, and he played, I'm trying to get this right now, he played Eruption, must have been a bit older, Eruption by Tiny Maria.
Yeah.
Peak time, Saturday night, over 1,000 people, probably
really?
A couple of 1,000 people.
Wow, yeah.
Alongside all the boogie disco where he was playing, he played Eruption, not even Come With Me.
No. That's quite brave, isn't it? Bloody hell.
So that's what people forget about him. And he almost, I mean, there's a bit of your style that's a bit hilly, a little bit kind of, you'll shout down the mic and you will order people to do things.
Yeah.
Dance.
That's right, yeah.
Sit down.
Yeah. That's my background. Yeah, I unashamedly don't mind admitting that. You know,
no, it's nothing to be ashamed of. I think Hilly was, is still. You know, I mean, his influence not only as a DJ but also in what he did as a record label person.
Yeah.
I mean, he signed Sinead O'Connor, the Boomtown Rats, all that stuff. So he had quite a big, wide... Someone should write a book about him.
I know.
That's your next step.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, do you know what? That's the nicest thing, though, so far, is that... other than the lovely things you've been saying, the lovely, lovely compliments you've been saying, Giles, today, other than that, I mean, Chris Hill... actually phoning me and telling me how much my book means to him, that's such an incredible thing for someone that I've held in such high esteem over the years to turn around and say that. He's achieved anything you can achieve,
I think it must have been difficult for him over the last few years to see how, because in a way he predated the whole DJ movement, right?
Yes.
Even though he was earning superstar wages and he was the only one in the UK earning that, he must have seen everyone just go ballistic when he was already getting a bit too old. But I know he was always a big jazz head, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he was, his influence is incredible. And I think it's important that someone like him is written about more, because I don't even think that people like him were particularly heavily written about in books like Last Night a DJ Saved My Life and all that. Not really.
They're
right?
spoken about derogatory.
Yeah, a little bit like jazz funk. It's kind of like it was. He got the bad end of the sort of the people throwing water the beer thing, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
which is unfortunate and not fair. But yeah, Hilly. It's good that he's in there, and Jonesy, because in a way, I think you write this in the book, is the fact that, you know, he would be in the room next door at Caister, and he would be the one playing Impressions by John Coltrane.
That's right, yeah.
And in a way, he was one of the key jazz dance elements of the movement, because Hilly didn't go that far deep in a way. It was a bit too elitist for him, wasn't it? He didn't really want to be. He was happy to throw it in the main crowd, but he was never that comfortable being.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hilly. In fact, he only just said that to me a couple of nights ago on the phone. That he said that he, he's always seen that music as being played together, all the different styles. You know, with Philly soul and disco and funk boogie, jazz funk, all played together in one room. That's the way he's always wanted it. He never really agreed with the whole thing, where, say, when Paul Murphy came along and was just doing it in one room all night long, he never saw it as an elitist thing. And I said to Chris, well, you know, at the end of the day, mate, you were still playing stuff like, you know, you're not going to get much heavier than Love Samba, McCoy Tyner. You know, you're not going to get much heavier than that. I mean, he would think nothing of playing that at the Goldmine, you know, right in the peak of the evening. Chris says about Bob exactly as you say, that, you know, Bob, in a way, Bob's always been the small room kind of DJ. You know, that's where Bob belongs. You know, in the moody room, you know, really playing the deep stuff. You know, and he can play that because you can't play Impressions Coltrane, you know, to 2,500 people in the main hall at Caister. You can't do that.
Yeah. We've all tried.
You would, I know you'd have a go. Oh dear. And I also think if Jonesy hadn't have started experimenting with the bop stuff on the floor, I don't know whether anyone else would have cottoned on to that, because, you know, he was, again, no one had touched bebop on the dance floor before Jonesy, and he is an unsung hero. I mean, as Bob's always saying, as you well know this, Giles, Bob always says, oh, I don't like to shout about myself. You know, well, this book is shouting about him, the good thing about my book is that it's been published in Japan in Japanese. Chris Hill is going over there, Bob Jones is going over there, and Colin Curtis is going over there. You know, they've all got compilations coming out over there. You know, so it's. You know, because now, you know, they're at long last, they're being recognised as innovators of our jazz dance scene. You know, they're the roots of it, and it's good that it's recognised at last.
Wow, I think that's great that Hilly's going to Japan to DJ.
He's coming with me. He's coming with me in about 3 weeks' time. I'm over there for 3 weeks.
And what are you going to do? Where are you going to play?
I'm playing in Shibuya Duo. Various Blue Notes and various billboards. So there's 9 gigs all in all.
All around the book.
Yeah. It's over two things. My book is out there, and my latest CD, which came out over here last November, Communication, that's been released in Japan.
And you're going to be doing the live band there as well.
Doing the live band, wow. And I'm going to be doing something for the British Council, like a jazz dance thing with the Japanese Stax Groove jazz dancers and. Just trying to involve the Japanese jazz dance community as well, but also show them Chris Hill. You know, this is one of the originators of our scene. You know, and it's great. I've already seen the posters, and there's Chris on there, and it's fantastic.
Oh, how fantastic! So you're going to be going over there with Hilly, Bob Jones.
Bob and Colin. Bob. Chris, Bob and Colin have all got a jazz compilation out, each coming out, called it's called the Innovators of Jazz Dance Series, volumes 1, 2, 3, and later on this year they're all going out there to DJ as well, to do, you know, so and about time too.
Yeah, about time too. That's fantastic. Now that actually brings me on to the northern southern thing in a way,
yeah,
because of Colin Curtis, and he was a big influence on me because I was going up to Manchester to see my friend who was at university there, mm, and I'd go to Berlin's every now and again and I'd hear him playing his style of jazz dance, mixing it up with the dance music of the time,
yeah,
and obviously you had to incorporate that. I mean, that's a massive part of our culture, mm, on the jazz dance scene as well, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and that was all your drives up to Leeds when no one would turn up.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. It's great that you know what I was what I'm pleased about is, about my book is that when I do the interviews, you know, I try and keep away from that north-south divide. The amount of rubbish I was told in the interviews, you know, all this kind of area pride. I can understand people being proud of their areas, of course I can, but, you know, if they're going to tell me, you know, I want to know why they're proud of the area, you know, what you know, if something supposedly started there, then why did it, and give me evidence of it, you know. I was forever cross-referencing everything to try and get to the bottom of it. And when I put the interviews together in the book, I decided, rather than, you know, just, you know, say, right, this is Essex, there's London, there's Manchester, there's Birmingham, I just started square. I thought it was the most fairest thing to do was to start at Scotland and work the way down the country, you know, and eventually finish in London. Well, I did a little bit of a kind of a funny route, but because I went down the country and then past Bristol down to Devon, you know, Sussex, Surrey, Essex, and then London, you know. So, but I thought it was the fairest thing to do, everyone's stories are told as you go down the country, mm, and there's a lot of cross pollinization going on there, which is great, you know. And there's a lot, you know, so. And also just trying to avoid, as you say, trying to avoid all this north-south divide thing, you know.
We've run out of record.
Oh, have you? Oh,
yeah,
well.
That's all right. That's okay.
Was it playing in the background?
That was playing. And no, I've got to say at this point that Mark hasn't got headphones on. We've only got one pair of headphones in this studio. And one of them, actually, one half of the ear keeps coming off. So
you might
get a little bit of feedback that's just popped in every now and again. But can you pass me another record anyway?
Yes.
That was Aerial, one I haven't heard for a long time.
Well, let's put Pacific Jam on.
Oh, we've got to do that. We've got to do that. Actually, we've got to talk. When you pull out a record like Pacific Jam, it makes me think of Chris Bangs.
Right.
Because I remember hearing him play that at the Rio in Didcot.
Okay.
And I suppose where Kiris Hill was a big influence on you living in Essex,
yeah,
me living in Surrey, sort of South London,
yeah,
it was people like Chris Bangs and Tarun and guys like that who were a big influence to me. And it's good to see that he's in the book as well. And he's, in a way, he's the one responsible for this horrible thing that was acid jazz.
Bangsy, yes. I know, yes.
Which track? Are we playing Night Trip or Anto's?
Anto Di Minada.
Oh, okay. That's a different one to the, what I never used to play that.
You were going to play the Batucada on there, or were you going to play the jazz funk track?
I used to like Night Trip on this, but are you talking about Antas de... Oh, here we go. See, my ear went off there.
Yeah.
Antas de Maias Nada, that one.
Anto Di Minada, your track. Yeah.
We're both saying it. I'll tell you what, let's play it, and then we'll continue the conversation we can talk about. Let's just see how this one drops at this moment in time, and see if it sounds good.
There you go. We'll be right back.
Oh, we went off a little bit, didn't we, just now? But it happens in podcasts. There's no production here.
Right. No.
It's like, as you said, Southport Radio.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Is
yeah,
this better or worse than Southport Radio?
Well, it's the same, isn't it? You know, we're almost back to pirate radio again here, aren't we?
I love it.
Yeah.
We were actually talking about the North-South divide, and then for some odd reason I went into Chris Bangs in Rio and Didcot,
yeah,
which is very unfair. So where were we going with the... you went around the country.
Yeah, I said I started off with Scotland and worked the way down, because I was trying to avoid all this North-South dividers. You know, I didn't stand for any of that in the I didn't stand for any of that in the interviews. You know, I appreciate if something started somewhere first, that's fine. But it's a lot of people would say you never had it down south, or people down south saying, oh, they never did that up north. But the people would say that without actually giving any evidence of, you know, other than it, you know, an opinion being based on area pride, you know. So,
but anyway, this is the point. Paul Bradshaw's just walked in with your publisher's just walked in with a copy of the book that neither of us had up
yes.
until this point. So we're very happy about that. But hey, let's get to the bottom, the bottom end. I was going to say,
yeah,
right,
okay.
North or south? Who invented the jazz dance movement? Where did it start? In your opinion, having interviewed everyone, is it? I mean, Northern Soul, we know where that started.
I know it sounds sitting on the fence, but the way things were in those days, you know, I just think that Colin Curtis, Chris Hill was playing jazz long before anyone else. That's a fact. I mean, but the fact is, I think Colin Curtis did it in the North, and I think Colin came to. I think he just came to similar conclusions that they did, than Chris Hill and Bob Jones did down south, you know, and their scene was so different than ours, you know. So I know it sounds sitting on the fence, but Chris Hill was playing jazz before anyone else, but that's his background. He lived and breathed it through the 60s. But
okay, now the other thing I wanted to ask you was, in a way, I feel a little bit guilty having been part of this acid jazz movement.
Mm.
Should I feel guilty about that?
Why on earth should you feel guilty?
In the sense of, did it kill the jazz dance movement? Is it? Do you know what I mean? Was this?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Well, it's yeah. That's a good question. Because the jazz dance scene didn't run alongside acid jazz. You know, acid jazz became. The jazz dance scene became the acid jazz scene because it was more or less finished in the north of England anyway. It was probably only getting played at weekenders at that point in the north, and down south there was Baz was getting disappointed because the attendance was dropping in his Baz for Jazz, that is, you know, who I guess was your nearest rival. I would say that a lot of his attendances were dropping. He was getting quite down about it. There was a lot of resentment about all this new fun kind of thing coming through, but there's a lot, you know, in that scene, it's all very well people talking about the fun, there was a lot of very very serious music being played in there, you know. It was kind of getting back to the way the scene was in the 70s, where you could go to a night and hear loads of great music all played, you know, together, you know, all kinds of things. But I mean, the fact remains is that the heavier end of the jazz dance scene, yeah, I mean, you know, without a doubt, that kind of very, very much suffered. But I think it suffered, though, because of all the new DJs coming in on the scene that wanted to play acid jazz, you know, that they had no background they hadn't been around 10 years previous and seen, you know, how it came about. And It wouldn't occur to them to put an Art Blakey tune on, you know, or whatever, or Fela Kuti or something like that. You know, it was all, they wanted to get behind all this great new music coming through, and rightly so. I mean, you know, you have got to keep pushing new music all the time.
You know, what's funny for me is, like, I'm listening to all these records that we've been playing so far, this kind of boogie, jazz, funk stuff, really good stuff. And then we're about to play a record, which you're going to explain why we're playing it later on, but we're about to play Reverend Moses by Lou Donaldson. And I'm listening back to that now, and I'm like, I much prefer the jazz, funk, boogie stuff.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to it. Thank you. Yeah, it's funny, but I'd much rather play, I don't know, Pacific Jam than, I mean, something like Reverend Moses. Yeah. It reminds me of, I think we had to put the fun into it. It got a bit too serious.
Yeah.
That's, I think, why the whole jazz dance thing, and even now, I think reading the book, yeah, I suddenly remembered, actually, there was times it was so claustrophobic,
yeah,
because you just constantly felt that you had to be, yeah, so heavy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And, yeah, and this was where there'd be girls and there'd, yeah, be more smiling going on.
So yeah, but that's why Murphy got out of the Electric Ballroom, and that's why you got out of the Electric Ballroom.
Yeah, in the
because
end,
you're all feeling stifled at having to play 1,000 miles an hour, to a heavy, tiny room, intense. You know, where the dancers were really, they were dictating what was being played, or certainly tempo-wise, more than, yeah, the DJ.
You know. But when you look back on the music that was being played in those rooms, there's no question about the fact that that was the most incredible, remarkable music being played.
Well, that's underground for you.
Which was all about the power and influence of Paul Murphy, because it all goes back to him,
yes,
to a degree, and
of
his
course.
Shop. And you look at records like Vladek Gorgalski's,
yeah,
soundtrack, and you're thinking,
yeah,
where did he hear that?
Yeah, yeah.
Where did he get that, yeah, stuff from?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's incredible. And it's not just like you go back to New York and you see these classics, the classics that Larry Levan played and David Mancuso and all those people. And there's a couple of 100 classic, records, bona fide New York classics,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Jazz fusion, jazz dance.
Yeah.
Paul Murphy came up with...
Yeah.
Hundreds.
Yeah, endless, wasn't it?
What was he doing?
I know.
What was he doing with his time? Going through sort of mole jazz? Is it all coming from mole jazz?
No. He was buying blind from out of one of the trade papers in America. Not wasn't Billboard, it was another one. He was just buying blind out of adverts, taking chances on,
yeah,
deleted jazz albums.
Amazing.
Yeah, and he was just uncovering tons and tons of stuff that had never been heard before.
Yeah,
here.
It's incredible. And... So that's the interesting thing about the story. But the book generally, you interviewed how many people in the end?
About 200, just over 200.
And who was the most? Who's the funniest interview you had? The most comfortable interview?
Oh dear.
Who's the funniest jazz DJ in the world?
The funniest.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
maybe Bangzi? Is there a sense of humour in jazz, in the jazz dance DJs?
I would say the interviews, because most of the people hadn't been interviewed before. They were very thorough-browed about it, and taking it very seriously about they were going to be in this book, and they're at last they've had a chance to tell their story. You know.
Yeah.
So
I know that your interviews are long. Gosh, I mean, you came here 3 times and,
yeah,
and at least 3 hours every time,
yeah,
and I ended up getting about 300 words. Where did it all go?
All the other people in there had about half a page or 3. Yours is about 4 or 5 pages.
I'm not complaining.
I know. You had to a lot of people were telling the same stories,
yeah,
time and time again. You know, it's, I know there were some people who, they haven't said to me, but I'm sure they're disappointed that they were. You know, most interviews on average about 2 hours to 3 hours each. I mean, people like yourself, Colin Curtis, Jonathan from Nottingham, Baz for Jazz. I think I said Bob Jones. A lot of you guys I've spent a lot more time on, and your interviews were a lot longer than anyone else's, because I wanted to get a little bit more about your background,
yeah,
rather than go straight into talking about your club days.
Well, it's free for someone like me, it's free therapy anyway, because you're just,
yeah,
talking about yourself for 3 hours. That's, you know, and,
yeah,
and you seem to be interested.
Yeah. Mind you, after I've done all the promotion for this book, after 6 months, I don't ever want to talk about it again. If I don't want to know any of you anymore.
Okay, let's play another track, because I'm getting tired of this Reverend Moses Baptist beat bullshit. So, do you think people are going to be interested in this book beyond really, you know, fanatical people, people like DJs and people like us? Can this go beyond? Are you hoping it goes beyond? Or is it just is this a specialist book for specialist people?
I'm hoping that the people that will buy this, I'm hoping that 90% of the people that buy this have nothing to do with our scene whatsoever, that are just interested in,
yeah,
like, you know, it's music history, it's black club culture, it's dance history, it's many things, and also, you know, there's other things that are touched on it, you know, like the origins of punk, football hooliganism, Northern Soul. You know, there's so many reasons to buy the book, you know, that, you know, so, and also, I mean, it's been like my professor friend from Yale, Professor Robert Ferris Thompson. I mean, he's using my book as part of his course there at Yale. You know, he's ordered 70 copies. So if he does, then there's a chance that Harvard are going to, and a lot of other colleges that specialise in black culture, you know. So we take it for granted because we've all been a part of it,
yeah,
you know, in whatever level.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story. And as you say, from the football hooliganism, the youth culture, the rockers, the Teds, the soul boys, the casuals, the weekenders, the clubs, the black, the white, you know, the north, the south. It's, yeah, it's all there in a period of time. Really sort of late 70s, early 80s, really, that kind of period. One question, could that type of thing happen again in this digital age? Can there be a movement like there was, or will this never happen again? Is it just different, the way society is going to move on? And
yeah, I don't know. I kind of thought it was going to happen with house, you know, and maybe in a delayed reaction, it kind of is happening, and it's like, well, you're getting dance styles coming through with house now, aren't you? But I think that's, you know, because our scene took so many years to get where it got. You know, I mean, my book covers 25 years, almost, you know, from going through the jazz funk into people experimenting with fusion, for it breaking off into the harder stuff to the more commercial stuff, dance styles developing, a whole new crowd coming through, discovering the probably coming in just because of the harder edge of the jazz dance thing, predominantly black crowd in the early 80s, it's causing a whole new dance style. You know, it would have to be a great big movement of one style of music. Yeah. I was hoping that was going to happen with a broken beat,
But then again, one thing that you just said just now, as we were listening to the last record, you were at Southport this weekend,
yeah,
you played the full 60 minutes of Roffa Roffa Fight. It was possibly the biggest record of the weekend.
I think they asked
you to play it again the following
That's
day.
That's right.
Maybe 15 years ago, if you'd have done that, it wouldn't have gone down as well.
So, no, you're right. No, I agree. Yeah, it's true. But we need a whole, we need a movement though, don't we? That's the thing. That's, you know, there needs to be a weight of a countrywide movement for, in order for something like this to happen again. And I hope it will do.
Yeah.
I hope it will do.
I think there's definitely going to be new DJs discovering this music, because this music is incredible.
Yeah.
And you can't beat it.
Mm.
Simple as that. I mean, listen to this, Barry Miles.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, I know.
The Travellers.
I know.
Paul Bradshaw, the publisher.
He's right here.
Yeah. A final word. How's it been working with Snowboy?
Good in there.
On this project. How's it been?
Speaking with Mark.
Yeah, how's it been?
Well, fantastic. I've just sat here, you know, mesmerised by the conversation that's going on between you two. I mean, it's basically, that is the depth and the vibe that comes out in the conversation is reflected in the whole musical taste and a commitment to a scene, really. I mean, I think, you know, what becomes interesting, I think, is that, you know, when you start to ask about, you know, what is the link between, you know, then and now. I mean, I've grown through that whole period the same way. I come from the north originally, you know, and ended up in the south. I was around, you know, when you and Murphy were both playing, you know, coming out of the ballroom and stuff. And then, you know, there's the dynamism and that kind of excitement that takes place, you know, in different situations. So, you know, even you know, like you were saying, oh, well, you know, like that, you know, the Reverend track, the Baptist Beat track, you know, sounds a bit dry compared with what you were playing earlier. But then I can, you know, I listen to that and hear a certain moment and reflect on a certain moment in the WAG club or something.
And me, yeah.
Where you just thought, whoa, kicking off. Nice girls in the corner, man. Check that out. And they're all dancing to this. You know what I mean? And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, where suddenly, something opened up in a particular way. People were, you know, open to a style of music that was basically seen as the domain of a bunch of fat jazzers down at Mole Jazz. You know what I mean? It was kind of suddenly had a freshness to it. What's interesting now, like you were saying, you know, like within the house scene or whatever, you know, to a degree, it's got to be about young people, you know, it's got to be about kind of, you know, the youth finding their own kind of depth in a way. I mean, I think we live in a society which is pretty shallow as it stands at the moment. But like you said, it's very interesting, you know, when you, if you go onto YouTube and you see all the youths there practicing jungle skank or tribal skank or migraine skank or whatever, and they're all kind of popping their little moves, and then you watch them go off into their own little groups afterwards and start improvising, and you see kind of hip-hop moves creeping in, you see little bits of African dance, you see, you know, steps that, you know, could fit with a jazz thing. It all becomes kind of interesting, you know. And having just popped up on the Chaser Publications UK Jazz Dance blogspot, a little thing that Andy Thomas said, oh, check this out, and it's Foot Patrol dancing in Moss Side Community Centre.
Yeah.
And they're all there, they've got braces on one shoulder, man, they got spats on. It's proper hardcore
fusion.
Yeah.
To house.
To house, man. Yeah. You know, and acid house, you know, it's pure bleep bleep business. And it's like, from that point of view, what is the difference between that and a funky house now? People can still work those kind of moves into that kind of scenario. It's all about the youth, it's all about the DJs having a little bit of vision, pushing the consciousness a little bit further. You know, and somebody said to me the other day, what is also interesting about that is, you pick up the paper in this town, and all you see is pictures of black kids with hoods on, stabbings, everything else. You go onto YouTube, and all you see is young black people, man, in there, learning how to dance to these funky tunes.
Yeah.
Hundreds of them. You know what I mean? Not some little posse on the housing estate. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a real positivity that should be bigged up and given kind of life by the people who've got responsibility in the media and all that.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is connecting up a history. You know what I mean? It's like connecting up a history of people who come off housing estates, come from different places, learned how to do dance styles, which now are not just seen by us here because of the internet, seen by people in America, seen by people in Japan.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's a movement which, for us, fortunately, has travelled all around the world. And I think from that point of view, you know, it becomes really interesting. And therefore, you sort of see a scenario where you've got kind of, you know, complicated music that people kind of, like you say, you know, where did they find this tune? And it is all that kind of mad cross-referencing and people taking chances and thinking, I'm going to play this tonight and see what happens.
Yeah.
And then those people on the dance floor who can do those kind of steps going, I can do this.
Yeah.
I can handle this tune. I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, that kind of attitude, yeah, it'd be lovely to see it back, mate. You know what I mean?
Where's the book?
The book is...
What have you done with it? It's gone. We had it.
Teethed it, mate.
It's here. Okay, from jazz, funk and fusion to acid jazz, the history of the UK jazz dance scene, written by Mark Snowboy Cockgrove. It's out, it's available where and how.
Best place to buy it is via authorhouse.co.uk or .com.
Authorhouse.co.uk.
Yeah, okay. Because basically, Snowboy gets more money from there.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It's available everywhere, but in all bookshops, but... If you buy it from there, we make much more royalties.
Okay, well, you deserve it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure. We should definitely do a part two. We should do a mix, actually, because I think we're going to get a lot of people asking for the records without us two blabbering over them. But anyway, listen, congratulations for the book.
Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it.
And thanks to coming, Paul, with a copy of it. I can have mine, because I gave my copy to Jez Nelson. Can I have this one?
Yeah.
And there's going to be a hardback version as well. For the
Swifty is talking about doing a very exclusive hardback, which is going to cost an arm and a leg to whoever buys them.
No, you need
but
to
they
that.
Will be beautiful.
Yes.
Wonderful.
You know.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, mate.
Check you later.